From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a 33-year-old woman received a phone call. Her cousin, she just found out, has breast cancer. Not her mother, not her sister, but her cousin. And she is immediately wondering, does this mean that I need to get screened? Should I get a genetic test? What exactly is that? Does insurance cover that? Imagine the concern or the confusion. This happens all the time. Now imagine someone has had swollen lymph nodes because of a COVID vaccine or a fall cold. Should they delay getting screened? The pandemic has caused confusion, too, when we talk about treatments, procedures. Boy, it gets mixed up pretty quickly here. But they've heard it all. The experts have. And this hour, we aim to answer as much as we can for you. We have not only two of the experts who know the most on these subjects, from screening to treatment, but also two important personal stories to share this hour. Let me welcome first the experts I just mentioned. In studio with us is Dr. Avis O'Connell, Director of Women's Imaging, Professor in the Department of Imaging Sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. O'Connell, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
On the line with us is Dr. Carla Falkson, a Medical Director of the Pluta Cancer Center, Director of the Breast Oncology Clinical Research Program and Breast Cancer Service Line, and Professor in the Department of Medicine at the Cancer Center at the Wilmot Cancer Institute. Dr. Falkson, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Also with us is Andrea Reynolds, a mother and a metastatic breast cancer advocate. Andrea, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
And the last thing we thought we'd be doing when the year began was welcoming the executive producer of Connections as a guest. Megan Mack is being treated for breast cancer and has come a long way since February. Hi.
Hi. That's right.
You kind of hate being interviewed and being on the side, don't you?
I do. I'm much more comfortable behind the glass with MRA and Rob. But I am here because we have a really important message to share. And I'm sitting in this chair because of Dr. O'Connell and Dr. Falkson, and I cannot thank them enough for the work they've done for me and so many other people in our community.
Well, to be clear here, this hour is, Megan has made it clear to me, and will stress to listeners, it's not just about Megan and her story. This is one of many stories that I think will be important for people to hear. Andrea is with us with a perspective of someone who wants to make sure we keep focus on a range of research and effort and concern about metastatic breast cancer. And realistically, we're going to talk about this kind of month, where over the years we've seen everything from the NFL players wearing pink shoes to ribbons everywhere. Is that helpful? Is that pink washing? And what should the public actually know? So there's a lot of ground to cover. But I want to start with Dr. O'Connell, just to kind of make sure we hit things that might be on a lot of people's minds. Let's start with the pandemic and the complications or confusions people may feel, literally just from having swollen lymph nodes. I mean, you hear this kind of thing all the time, I imagine.
Yes, the big message is you need to get your vaccine and get your mammogram. At the beginning of COVID, people were wondering would they put off their mammogram because they'd heard about swollen lymph nodes. And some people did put off their mammogram for that reason as well. But we want to tell people that we know what to do if we see enlarged lymph nodes. So don't put off your mammogram, because that's the worst thing you could do. We know that actually quite a few, between 25 and 50% of women, within 2 to 4 weeks of their vaccine, get swollen lymph nodes in the armpit on that side. And if they have their mammogram or their MRI during that 4 weeks, those lymph nodes will show abnormal. But at first we fussed about them and we worried that this person had metastatic cancer or something. And now the literature and the communications are telling us quite clearly that it's very common to cool it. Don't run in with a biopsy needle. Do a follow-up in 4 to 6 to 8 to 12 weeks. I like 3-month follow-up. By then, most of it's gone.
Okay. How often have you heard of people saying, you know, I'm just not going to do it right now?
Do which? The vaccine or the mammogram?
Well, after the vaccine, no mammogram.
Nope. Yeah, we do. No, not really. But there was enough confusion that people said, we heard people are being falsely diagnosed with cancer because of their COVID. It didn't really happen. We did call people back in the same way we call them back when we're worried about cancer. But as soon as we call them back, and the history now tells us, had her vaccine 2 weeks ago, left arm. And so we know that. Then we look at it, we measure it, and we say, it's okay. We're pretty sure in your case, it's COVID. We'll check you in 3 months. Now, if that person came for a high-risk screening and we're getting an MRI in their 30s because they have a really high history, we will be very careful before we tell them not to worry. If we had to do a biopsy because there was concern, it's a needle biopsy. it would be something we would consider. So depending on the history, if it's a screening mammogram in a 55-year-old, we're not going to fuss if they have no risk. If it's a 35-year-old having an MRI because of high risk and half their family, female-wise, are, you know, struggling with this thing, we would maybe do the biopsy because peace of mind is really what we need. And it would probably be benign, but it would be a long time to wait. 3 months if you're worried about cancer would be too long.
Okay. And it looks to me certainly that COVID will be endemic at some point. You know, we'll be sort of doing our best to manage it and prevent harm from COVID. But I mean, very, very unlikely that we'll eradicate COVID. So your community is dealing with it?
Yes. And going forward, this is an important point because we'd probably be getting boosters every year. Now, people have been getting flu vaccines and shingles vaccines for years, but there's something more, if you like, immunogenic about the COVID vaccine. So going forward, we'll say to people, look, if you can schedule your mammogram for next year, 4 weeks before, say, 4 weeks before you have your mammogram, if you can do that, because for next year, you could start planning, book to have your COVID a month before, and then there probably won't be the same problem. But the message is get your mammogram regardless, because honestly, delayed diagnosis of breast cancer is a much worse thing than a swollen lymph node.
That's the screening perspective. Dr. Falkson, on the oncology side of things, has your work been complicated at all during this pandemic?
Yes, definitely. A lot of patients have, as Dr. O'Connell just said, postponed getting diagnosed with breast cancer. So that's been something of a concern. But I think the message is out there now that they shouldn't be delaying, and especially getting their screening mammograms. And patients who are immune compromised, of course, we would like to have them avoid contact as much as possible. So we've changed to doing a lot of our consultations via video consults, which has been different from before the pandemic. A lot of patients still come in to see us in person. And then, of course, there's the question of the vaccine, where we've strongly encouraged our patients to get vaccinated to protect them, because we don't want them to be getting COVID, especially if they're in a vulnerable population or getting chemotherapy for their cancer. They are particularly susceptible, so we've encouraged those patients to get vaccinated as quickly as it's available.
Yeah, let me stress that point one more time that Dr. Falkson is making, because there's a bit of a parallel to pregnancy and questions about people who are pregnant and then asking, should I get vaccinated? Is there a concern with the vaccine? I mean, the research, what we know is it's so good and still so important to be vaccinated if you're pregnant, if you're dealing with cancer. And so I just want to stress again, Dr. Falkson, you're saying that should not, if there's someone in your life with cancer, that should not immediately shut you down from feeling like you need to be vaccinated or boosted.
No, quite the opposite. You should run out and get a vaccine. If you or somebody in your family have, if you're a caregiver for somebody who's getting treated for cancer, then it helps to protect them if you also get a vaccine. So yes, patients and caregivers should be getting vaccines.
Well, we're not going to, I promise we're not going to focus the whole hour on you, Megan Mack, but but listeners care about how you're doing. And if you could, why don't you take people back a little bit to the beginning of your story here, which is most of this calendar year.
Actually, I would say it started last October during a discussion we had about breast cancer awareness with Dr. Falkson and Dr. O'Connell and a very good friend of mine, Steph Tubman, who was diagnosed when she was 34, and she came on to talk about some of what she was going through and a clinical trial that she was in. And in February, when I discovered a lump in my breast, at first I didn't think anything of it. It hurt a little, so I wanted it taken care of. I went to my OBGYN, and she said, it's a benign fibroadenoma. Don't worry about it, but I'll send you for imaging anyway, just to be sure. And I remember walking out of the door of that office thinking, it's probably nothing. She told me not to worry, so I won't. But then I thought back to this conversation that we had and what happened with my friend Steph, and I thought if it can happen to her, it can happen to me. So I went to my imaging. I was diagnosed on the spot. It was a...
That's unusual, isn't it?
I think, I don't know. I'll let Dr. O'Connell weigh in on that.
Yes. No. not. A young person with a lump who's not pregnant or lactating, you can tell very quickly the difference between a fibroadenoma and a cancer. So
even without a biopsy?
Even without the biopsy. Sometimes we hedge a little to give the person time to process it.
Maybe that's where I'm going with
it. I had about 3 minutes, so a little time would have
been
nice.
3 minutes to process.
I actually have seen enough times where there's enough things that look ugly and are not. And the worst thing I think, and this is not reflecting on whoever decided that to you, but I'm just saying, I like to say to somebody, I'm worried enough to get a biopsy, but I've seen enough things. Fibroadenomas can look really odd. There's all kinds of things that are not cancer. So I say, look, it'll be 24 hours. I'll get you the result tomorrow. We'll do the biopsy. You just have to hold it. You have to distract yourself tonight. You'll get the result tomorrow. I don't want to tell you today you have cancer when I don't have proof. The worst thing is to call the person up and say, it would be a good thing to call the person up and say, well, it wasn't
cancer.
That's
a lot of painful stress there.
It's one more day, one more night,
yeah.
And that'll be a long night.
Yeah.
I prefer to wait.
Gotcha.
And the person's brain knows very well.
Of course.
And they say to me, what do you think? What do you think? And I say, I've done this long enough. I don't want to tell you what I think because I know both sides of this. So let's just wait. So I'm glad you got the biopsy.
Yeah. And you had the 3 minutes to process the news here. Right on the spot there.
Yep, it all happened very quickly. The doctor that was doing the ultrasound at that point said, do you see that black mass? That looks suspicious. And I said, suspicious as in what? And she said, suspicious as in. And I said, cancer. And she said, it is cancer and it's in the lymph node too. And then I said, well, don't we need to do a biopsy first? And she said, we'll do that now. And then they did the biopsy and 15 minutes later, I was in my car wondering what the heck just happened.
I recall you. Can you just share briefly that moment your life is changing? And you said that you didn't have any family with you.
With COVID, you couldn't bring anyone with
right.
you.
And so you're sitting there alone. And what did they give you, like a brochure?
Oh, my goodness. So they brought in a survey to ask about how they were doing. Did I like their furniture? Did I like the amount of time that we talked about the diagnosis before the biopsy? And being a very type A person, I filled out the survey because I have to do things. But it was a joke. It was a joke.
See, I would have issues with that because I feel like there's, I'm sure, huge psychology of patients and worries. If I were doing it, I'd be doing the biopsy. It would be done. But I would not have given you a survey. I would not have come out and said for sure because I'd be still hoping as well. I'd get a good enough biopsy that the answer will be there. And if you said, I'd say, I'm worried. Yeah, I'm worried. But let's just hold. And I'd do the same thing. Because I have concerns. If you got in a car and then drove into the bushes, whose fault would it be? I feel like, and sometimes I say to people, would you come back when there's somebody with you? And it's not that you need somebody to drive you, but you need another person.
Sure.
To be with you. So COVID or no, it'd be nice to have somebody in the parking lot to drive you home. For moral support, if nothing
emotional
else.
Support.
I
yeah.
know. So one more day, you
yeah.
see. There's two sides to this. People love same-day biopsies. And I do when the person lives 2 hours away or something. But there are times where it's like, would you like to come back tomorrow? Bring mm-hmm. someone with you. And they'll say, should I do it now? And you say, it's going to be the same tomorrow. So
yeah.
There are two sides to this.
So let's also set that aside and say, I share that because our listeners know you so well. And you went through hell with that. That was tough. But from that moment on, you talk about the kind of support you've had
mm-hmm.
that has been so important and powerful. And I mean, I know it's been a tough journey, but can you take people through a little bit of where you've gone?
Absolutely. And I think Andrea can speak to this as well, because no one ever has a good diagnosis experience, but I love where I'm treated. I'm at Pluta Cancer Center. The second I walked in the door there, I felt like I had made a good decision. And I have so many people to thank for the great care I've received and the treatment. And I did 24 weeks of chemo, two different regimens. And then we took a short break. I had surgery on October 5th, which went very well. And my thanks to my surgeon and Dr. O'Connell, who was a big part of that. And now we're just waiting to see what might be next. I know I'll have to have radiation, but there's some decisions we have to make before we can start down that path for sure. But I think your treatment team, and I'm sure Andrea can weigh on this as well, it means the world to you, and to know that you're working with people that you have confidence in and who know you as a person, and you're not treated like a number. And I joke that Pluta is like the Cheers of cancer centers, because everyone knows your name. You walk in there and the person at the front desk says, hi, Megan, hi, Andrea. They know who you are right away. And it just makes the whole experience much more comfortable, despite all the honestly terrible things that you have to do to try to get through it.
Mm. Andrea, can you share a little bit about where it started for you?
Sure, yes. I was 31 when I was first diagnosed with stage 3. I had found a small pea-sized spot in my breast when I was at the end of my second pregnancy. So and it was actually not until 18 months later that I was actually diagnosed, because, you know, their doctors were like, well, it's probably nothing. We can't image you when you're 8.5 months pregnant. Come back when you're done breastfeeding. So did that, and then we actually moved. I breastfed for almost a year, and then we moved, and then after that, I was like, all right, I should probably get this looked at. It's bigger now. And so I was 31, and we have got no history in my family, so that was a huge, huge shock. And I did all the treatment, surgery, chemo, radiation. And then I was on a maintenance treatment for 5 years until in 2019, when I had a lot of leg and back pain that just got progressively worse no matter what I tried or no matter who I saw, physical therapist, chiropractor, massage, I tried it all. So finally the MRI showed that I had quite a bit of bone metastases throughout my spine and other parts of my body. So that was in 2019. I was 37. And I'm also at Pluta, and they're fantastic. So I'm very fortunate so far to be stable as of now, which is great. But every month, kind of hold your breath for the blood work and cross your fingers that things are still looking okay.
Andrea, can you describe, and then maybe I'll ask Dr. Falkson to follow up. You said you were stage 3. Megan, you were stage 2. Stage 3 meant what as it was described to you, Andrea?
So from what I remember, stage 3 was based on both the size of the tumor and the extent that it was in my lymph nodes when they took the lymph nodes out from my surgery. There were several that were impacted. So that's how I understand it, is those two things combined.
Okay. Dr. Falkson, can you add to that?
That's completely correct. We look at the tumor size, we look at the lymph nodes, and then only if it's gone outside of the breast and immediate lymph node area, say, for example, into the bone, or some distant place, would we call it stage 4 or metastatic.
Okay. And Andrea, it sounds like you had a little bit of the reverse of Megan's course. You had surgery first?
Yes, I had surgery first because the tumor was, fairly large at that time, and they wanted it out, and they figured, you know, we could do chemo first, but it's not going to change it enough to be able to save the tissue, to save any breast. So, and I wanted it off too. I mean, immediately, you know, as soon as you get that diagnosis, it was just like, can someone please just take this thing off of me? So, I went through surgery first. So it really just depends on, the patient and what, you know, the size and placement and what their options are.
Okay. And I also want to ask you a little bit about, well, I mean, look, I know you think about it, you say every month, you think about how you're doing, you think about what your prognosis is. It would be trite for me to tell you, I'm sorry about where you are with this. I am. And can you kind of give us a sense for, as you understand it now, what the management of this means for you going forward?
Yes. Well, for metastatic or stage 4 breast cancer, we are on treatment forever, because if you get off the treatment, we already know that the cancer has spread to other places and has, you know, taken up residence there. So if you go off treatment, it's going to continue to grow. So it really is, you're on a treatment, they start you on what they think is going to, you know, be best for you first. And then is when that treatment fails, you try the next one. So for me, I'm very lucky to have lasted just over 2 years on my first line of treatment. And I just hope that it lasts long enough for other options that will keep me alive even longer to come out. I consider just buying myself time for more research to make further progress.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you mentioned, I mean, Megan's cancer has been a great education for me. Are you pointing at something?
I'm just telling you to look at Spark.
Oh.
Producing while I'm talking on the show.
Oh, I see.
There's something important that we'd like to add to Andrea's points. So,
okay, let me just close the loop on one point here. Andrea, did your cancer, do we know what fueled it? Was it HER2? Was it estrogen, progesterone?
Yes, it's the hormone positive. My first diagnosis, I was kind of borderline with the HER2. The results came back questionable, of course. I'm like, oh, cool. I'm in this tiny little sliver of people, and here's another little tiny sliver. Mm. So I'm hormone positive, and that's what I've been treated for. So I'm in medically induced menopause.
Okay. Dr. Falkson, when we look at the kinds of breast cancer, often people learn about it only when someone they know or themselves is in it. And that was certainly the case for Megan's colleagues. We're learning all about, you know, what that means. Can you just kind of give us a brief rundown of what the different kinds mean?
Yes. So there are different kinds of breast cancer. And you pointed out one of the big differences is those that are hormone sensitive or hormonally driven. You can almost think of it as the hormone is the growth factor or the food for these cancers. They are what we would call estrogen receptor positive and or progesterone receptor positive. If they don't have that, then we call them ER negative. Then we come to another factor that you touched on is the HER2. This is a protein that is expressed on up to a quarter of breast cancer cells. And think of it just as if you look at the cancer, it just looks a little different, but it has this special HER2 protein expressed on it. This makes these cancers more aggressive, but we now also fortunately have targeted therapies, antibodies that can go and specifically attack those HER2 positive cells. For example, the drug called trastuzumab. But I'm getting away from myself, let me get back to the types of cancer. So you can have breast cancer that hormone positive, ER and PR positive, and HER2 positive, or you can have breast cancer that's ER positive, PR positive, HER2 negative, or you can have cancers that don't have any of those. That would be the triple negative breast cancer if there's no hormone receptor and also no HER2 expression. So that sort of gives you the big groups of breast cancers.
And Derek Thompson had a piece in The Atlantic just this morning about how mRNA technology could potentially create vaccines for certain kinds of cancers. And, you know, this was a story that sort of just hearing this kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I'll read a little bit of what Thompson writes in The Atlantic today. Quote, this month, BioNTech announced that it had initiated phase 2 trials of personalized cancer vaccines for patients with colorectal cancer. It is working on other personalized cancer vaccines and exploring possible therapies for malaria using a version of the mRNA technology that had its breakout moment in 2020. And of course, mRNA, listeners probably know by now, the technology that's associated with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Dr. Falkson, do you hold out hope that there are vaccines for cancer, at least specific kinds of cancer, on the horizon?
Yes, I do. I think this is very exciting. This mRNA technology, definitely, I think it was originally that was the goal, that they thought they would start looking for treatments for cancer. And then sort of as a spin-off figured, oh, they could use it for viruses as well. Yes, I'm very optimistic that we are going to see some vaccines for cancers in the near future that give good results.
I mean, it's amazing to me. And Dr. O'Connell, I know screening is your bag, not necessarily oncology, but I mean, when you read about stories like this, what stands out to you?
Well, this brings me to a topic that I think you're going to get to about clinical trials.
Yeah, let's
the
do that.
Minute there's, I think that many people with cancer, and when they go to a big cancer center, will hear about or be invited to join in a clinical trial. And I'm just going to make a pitch here that this is where the new things happen. Nobody will ever be put on a trial arm that won't treat them properly. They won't be a kind of control who gets nothing. But these kind of vaccines, possibly, or treatments, immunotreatments, are how we drive the cancer treatment. People are living long, long lives with cancer today who wouldn't have 10, 15 years ago. I just want people to know when a clinical trial is mentioned and you're a patient, look at it carefully, because there may be, you won't get worse treatment, but you may get something new that the general public won't have for a while. So just, it's not doing research on a person as a guinea pig. It's offering you today's state of the art and then maybe tomorrow's state of the art as well.
I'll ask Dr. Falks to weigh in on this in a second, but just to follow up with you, Dr. O'Connell, you know, when you say you hear clinical trial, do not think guinea pig. Mm-hmm. It almost seems to me that the pandemic has made that point even more important to stress because of some of the debate about, well, how long were the clinical trials for the vaccines? And you hear people, some people who didn't want that, claiming that, well, we're all guinea pigs at part of the trial, which, of course, not true.
Not true.
But I know that that has made things more sensitive. So
let me make one point.
Yeah.
I think when it comes up, I'm going to bring up the word trust. If you're in a group that you trust and you have an oncologist you trust and a team that you trust and they suggest this and you trust them because you can't read all the literature that they've been reading for 20 years, you have to trust somebody. So if the person who's taking care of you says, I think this would be a good trial for you to participate in, just listen them, see them out. Don't try and double think everything and say they're just trying to use me as a guinea pig.
Yeah, Dr. Falkson, do you want to add to that on clinical trials?
Yes, I think in my experience of doing clinical trials for many years, I always give my patients the different options of what they can do and what kind of treatments are available to them. So I think educating people is very important, and educating them and knowing what the options are. And then it's their right to choose. Do they want to participate in a clinical trial or don't they want to? And over the years, more often than not, patients have felt that it is right for them. But each case is going to be different. Each case is going to be unique. I do agree with Dr. Connell, though, that if your oncologist or doctor offers you a clinical trial, absolutely consider it seriously, because it's a big, definite possibility that you're going to be offered something that is not yet available to the general public, but that may very soon change the standard of care for breast cancer treatment, improving it further. And that would be the only way that you would be able to get access to such a new treatment. So yes, I definitely support clinical trials.
And Dr. Falkson, on a clinical trial that's apparently happening, approved at least in breast cancer, let me just read, extending on what Thompson was reporting, this is from verywellhealth.com. What about a vaccine for breast cancer? Quote, the FDA has approved a triple negative breast cancer vaccine for use in human clinical trials. The vaccine, developed by researchers at the Cleveland Clinic, works by training the immune system to kill cells that express the protein alpha lactalbumin. That's the best I can do on that. And then it says the technology used to develop the vaccine could be applicable to cancers beyond breast cancer as well. Dr. Falkson, when it comes to triple negative, my understanding has been that that's been a harder one to treat, just because the way I think of it is you don't know what to target. You don't know what is causing the cancer. It's kind of a mystery. Are we feeling like alpha-lactalbumin is behind this, or how do you feel about this trial?
I think that there are different targets that are being identified in triple-negative breast cancer. We know that the targets are not the estrogen receptor or the progesterone receptor or the HER2. But some triple-negative breast cancers have other markers such as androgen receptors, We know some of them have another receptor that we call PD-L1, which makes them very susceptible to immune therapy. And so, yes, I think this is a specific subgroup of triple-negative breast cancers that certainly could be targeted very successfully by a vaccine like this.
Well, I don't know how Andrea feels about this. I mean, Megan, you and I have talked about the fact that you get diagnosed with breast cancer. It's amazing how many people in your life sort of close to you or even sort of tangentially that you find out have had it. I mean, it's, I think, what, one in eight, one in nine women in a lifetime. Dr. O'Connell's nodding at me. I'm remembering my stats pretty well. It's a lot of people over a lifetime. Hasn't it been remarkable how many people you found solidarity with, Megan?
Absolutely. It's a club no one wants to be in, but a lot of us say it has some really great members. And no matter what your situation, no matter, you know, what your diagnosis is, there's someone who understands your chemo regimen, your surgery, your, you know, hormone status. It's just, it's remarkable how much is going on and we're not really talking about it as openly as I now think we should. And every question that I've had, I've been able to talk to someone from a personal perspective. Hey, how did you get through this piece of it? Or what do you recommend for this side effect from chemo? And I know, Andrea, we've talked just off the air about some of these things. It's terrible that you have to navigate a lot of this, but you're never alone.
Andrea, you want to add to that? I mean, did you find the same thing, that sort of a surprise at how many people in maybe your sphere have had this?
Well, being fairly young when this happened, I didn't have any friends or peers mm-hmm. who had gone through it. But so many people typically older than me would call or message. And yeah, everyone just kind of came out of the woodwork. And then when this metastatic diagnosis came, it really opened my eyes to how many young women and men are living with metastatic disease. I mean, people think of it usually as, you know, more of an older person's disease, but the number of people in their 30s and 40s and even younger with this is, it's really heartbreaking because they're, you know, it affects a lot of your life. And many of us have, you know, not gotten to live the life we want yet. And it, but anyway, the point is, yes, and I want to give a shout out to the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester because they've been amazing, and they have support groups for everybody dealing with breast or gynecological cancers, and they also have a group specifically for metastatic, and that's been my lifeline.
I want to echo that. She's absolutely right. The Breast Cancer Coalition does such great work and connects people with – I have a mentor who I was put in touch with at the beginning of this process, who's been so helpful for me. And there's a new Facebook group for young survivors, or thrivers, they call us. And so if you're someone out there who's under the age of 40 and dealing with some of the things that we're talking about on the show, it's a great resource and a really wonderful community of people who have come together to support each other.
Now, Andrea briefly mentioned women, men, we often think of this as solely a disease for women. Dr. Avis O'Connell, this is the month typically where we think more about breast cancer, and this has been, I'm not usually a fan of calendar journalism, but this is a week where there's an effort made to make sure people understand that this can affect men. How often do you see that? What do you want the public to know about that?
Well, certainly this is Male Breast Cancer Awareness Week within the month of, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1% of the cancers we diagnose today are men.
Breast cancers.
Male breast cancers, yeah. 1% of the cancers we diagnose. It's important that nobody screens men regularly for breast cancer, but if men need to be aware that the symptoms would be a lump or discharge or redness or scaling of the nipple, you know, any changes that are abnormal to the man, their doctor needs to send them for a mammogram, yes, a mammogram, and an ultrasound. And it's not unusual. The men tend to be a little older. It's unusual for a young man to get breast cancer, but the age is more 60s, 70s, or even 80s for males. So if a male gets a breast lump, they need to have it checked. We check men every single day. it's a mammogram and an ultrasound. And commonly it's benign. Gynecomastia is what a benign breast enlargement is. But if it's a cancer, it's pretty obvious. Unfortunately, men don't run in to get checked and they don't get screened. So generally, men's breast cancers are a little more obvious because they're a little bit bigger. Because nobody, the guy doesn't.
Because it's gone longer.
Yeah, gone longer. Wow. They tend to be. So the thing is, their treatment is exactly the same. Their outcomes are a little less good because on average, they're diagnosed at a later stage because they wait longer. Because what guy thinks he's going to get breast cancer? So let me just put one red flag out there. We talk about genetic BRCA genes and genetic abnormalities. Yeah. If a person's family has a BRCA gene, particularly BRCA2, those are the groups that generally get male breast cancer more commonly. So it's important for the, looking back the family history, if Uncle Alfie or great-granddad had breast cancer, there's probably a genetic anomaly there. And guys should be, guys loosely, men should be more aware. So awareness for men, nobody's going to screen their mammogram every year, but just be aware.
Yeah. And, can you give us a just a brief sense on genetic? So I mentioned at the top of the hour, a woman finds out that a cousin has mm-hmm. it. Not a sister, not a mother, but a cousin. Yeah. Where are the standards on when we need to get checked?
So we generally look at a bigger family history than just first degree relatives, because sometimes you know, if you see multiple relatives having breast cancer, especially on the same side of the family, male, maternal or paternal, and if anybody has young cancer, you worry about genetics. So that person may get a genetic consultation to see, because it's not just BRCA1 and BRCA2 anymore. We have a dozen or more, well, more than that, of genetic abnormalities that tend to give breast cancer. But the BRCA1 and 2 are the ones we know best. So I think just to say what you said, if your family history shows a lot of cancer and if there's a red flag of any male who had breast cancer in your family, that person should have a higher awareness. Maybe get tested, okay. Genetic testing.
And for women, same?
Same, except more so. Again, we take the family history, grandmother and aunt, multiple aunts, but not mother. That person still may well have, it's not 100% penetrant. So if the genetic problem is there, and we do a calculation, and if it's 20% lifetime risk by our calculation, we suggest an MRI. If it's 15 to 20%, we suggest an ultrasound. And the average is the 12% you said there, 1 in 8. A 12% person just gets a regular mammogram.
Okay. And lastly then, for someone who is not in the genetic category, no genetic predisposition, women, what's the very latest? We always ask you this, but just remind people, the very latest, start screening.
You know the when? See something, do something slogan? Well, I think feel something, do something. So the message to any woman of whatever age, don't be embarrassed. You feel a lump, get it checked. If it's a fibroadenoma, we're great. If you're lactating and it's a lactational adenoma or a galactosele, we're all very happy. But there's no downside to getting an ultrasound if you have a lump at any age.
Okay. Dr. Falkson, just briefly on the story of men and breast cancer, you know, we can sort of laugh at men for never going to the doctor because we don't, but this becomes life and death, and it can. I mean, I probably myself need a biopsy for a throat condition. I am very well aware of men who drag their feet in getting care, even when they're in relationships. And we know that men who are not married, men who are single, die younger for exactly the reason Dr. O'Connell talked about. So Dr. Falkson, I imagine to the extent that you've worked with men, there's probably surprise. I mean, men are probably surprised that they could even be in your office.
Yes, you're quite right. But as Dr. O'Connell pointed out earlier on, if we look at how many people are diagnosed with breast cancer, only 1% of the breast cancer diagnoses will be in male patients, in men. So it is rare, but unfortunately, yes, I have seen men over the years with breast cancer. And yes, surprised, absolutely. The treatment, as we just briefly touched on, is very, very similar. There are subtle differences in men because men are slightly different. You have to figure their testosterone levels in as opposed to the ovarian estrogen in women. But I think that's too technical for this show today. But yeah, so definitely men should not be shy about seeking medical care or advice or diagnosis if they see something changing, a lump in a breast or an enlarging breast. And it's often just one side that'll change. And that's something they should definitely see a doctor about to have looked at further.
Yeah. See something, say something, feel something, say something, something yes, to remember. Yes. And Andrea Reynolds, who's a mom and metastatic breast cancer advocate. So we've been talking about everything from the impact of vaccines on lymph nodes to where the research is going now to future vaccines. But I know that one of your feelings as someone with metastatic breast cancer is that you want to make sure that there is focus and attention in different ways on treatment there. And I want to give you some space to talk a little bit about, you know, maybe how you see that now and what you'd like to see change.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, growing up, we've all seen the, you know, the pink ribbons everywhere, and it's kind of become, it's become part of October is everything turns pink. And it's important that people know where their money is going and if any money is going to any sort of nonprofit or research from that product. You know, we refer to it as pink washing, where people just turn things pink, but it's not necessarily doing anything to benefit cancer survivors or patients. And metastatic disease historically has been underfunded quite a lot. And it needs, if research to stage four cancer is increased, then it will make stages zero through three a lot less scary. And I know that when I was a stage three, I kind of didn't, I didn't even want to pay attention to stage four because I was too afraid of it. And here we are. But I'm wondering if some of, you know, the public misconception is that, well, once you're stage four, like you're done, there's nothing we can do for you. And that's the part that we need to change, because there are medications, there are treatments that are slowly prolonging our lives. You know, some of the studies come back and they say that, oh, they had an increase of 9 months. And it's like, well, that's great, but how about 30 years, please? Mm-hmm. So if more funding and research is focused on the metastatic end, then we can turn it into a chronic condition instead of a terminal illness.
Yeah, Andrea, I'm curious to get your thoughts on maybe the future of medicine. You and I are not, you know, medical researchers per se, but it's impossible for me to think that there's not a future at some point in which, as successful as chemo can be, for example, we don't need to damage the body to heal the body, or to damage the body to save the body, or to kill a tumor, or to reduce the size of a tumor, that we will have much more targeted medical treatment, whether it's things that are way beyond my understanding, literally nanotechnology, other kinds of treatments, et cetera. I have no doubt that that will happen. I don't know if that's in 10 or 50 or 100 years or whatever, but I think that we will get there. What I also wonder is for people who have metastatic, if there will be much more targeted treatment that either alleviates symptoms or frankly, you know, sort of wipes out a progression of disease even at that stage. I think we will get there eventually. I mean, we've done so much. That's not implausible to me. But I wonder if you think, if you maybe share that idea, but you think we're going to get to that last stage, stage four, more slowly, given the way research dollars are shaken out.
Well, currently, I think that's how it goes. And that's why it's so important for myself and for other advocates, whether they have stage four or not, to bring the stage four experience kind of even with the pink and, you know, that kind of you can get through it cheerleader kind of piece. So we're all aware of breast cancer. It would be great if we could, you know, just shine more light on the metastatic side, because one in three women diagnosed with early stage cancer is eventually going to metastasize. But the problem is we don't know why and we can't predict it. And I think right now there are targeted therapies. I'm on one that is very good at targeting, you know, the cancer and not necessarily all the other cells and tissue. So I think it's coming. But obviously any more dollars and research that can go specifically to metastatic disease is going to make those advancements come a lot faster. Yeah, they're in the works.
I'll ask the doctors to weigh in. And Dr. O'Connell, to be fair, I have read, and the experts know much more than I do, Andrea, Megan know much more than I do, that it's, you know, that people with breast cancer, 20 to 30% will get something, will end up with metastatic at some point in their lifetime. I mean, not necessarily next year or next decade, but at some point in their lifetime. So whether it's 1 in 5 to 1 in 3, I mean, it's a significant number at some point. And what do you make of Andrea's contention that maybe metastatic gets a little bit less attention, whether it's research funding, preparation, public awareness, Dr. O'Connell?
No, there's no question, because people love the bouncy stories, early detection. But so there's no question. And I think treatment for metastatic, especially bone metastatic, is much better than it was 5-10 years ago. There are some great success stories. So I think hopefulness and getting the latest and keeping in touch with your oncologist, hopefully who is keeping in touch with the latest. But let me flip the thing the other way. My dream would be that there's a blood test, and we're doing trials on these kind of things. The TMIS trial is one, which I mentioned last year. That if we could do a blood test on a 30, because as Andrea said, she had no family history, so nobody's going to do a genetic test on her before she had cancer. But if you got a blood test as part of your annual physical, when you turn 30, I mean, 30 is the number we're giving. If we could find that test that had some sort of a marker to say this person needs to start getting MRIs or mammograms because she's got something that might get, we're going that direction. This big TMIS trial is trying to do a blood test and then follow people for 8 years and then for the rest of their lives. Can we detect who's going to get breast cancer so that we can either predict who's going to get it and catch it when it's at its smallest? And that, of course, would mean that the outcomes down the line would be better. So I like to think that research and funding, and not just pink, because honestly, some of the pink thing was just people making money off it. But genuine research money might actually find a way to determine which people are prone to getting breast cancer way before they get it.
Dr. Falkson, do you want to weigh in on that too?
Yes, and I think so. Personalized screening definitely would help. And Laura Esserman's wisdom trial is looking at how to personalize screening for different people as well. I think results should be forthcoming in the near future. As for actually treating patients, I think we've made huge strides over the last few decades helping women with metastatic breast cancer. I like to talk of it as being a situation where I'd like to control the disease rather than curing the disease. But there are some situations, the so-called oligometastatic breast cancer, where we, as oncologists, have debates with our colleagues, surgeons and radiation oncologists, as to whether we can cure that subgroup of metastatic breast cancer. I think for people to understand that metastatic breast cancer, like we started off with a show talking about breast cancer, isn't just one disease. So if you have a triple negative metastatic breast cancer, that's more difficult to treat. But if it's a HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer, we have a large number of drugs that have made significant differences, added years to patients' median survival. So we're seeing a lot of advances, and it seems slow, and it's not as quick as we would all like, but it's definitely there. It's mm-hmm. slow, steady progress in the right direction.
All right, let me grab a phone call from Chris in Honeyway Falls. We got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. I heard you discuss the genetic and the BRCA1, BRCA2. I am not sure if I missed it as far as how many people in the family until you will get that genetic testing. In 2014, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. At that time, I only had one cousin on the maternal side that had breast cancer. So I was not given a genetic testing. However, in 2017, I had ovarian cancer, and then I was screened, and I was found to carry the BRCA1 mutation. So, my thought is, I obviously I came at a late time. Is that still the process, that if there is only one family member. They will not screen you.
Dr. O'Connell?
Yeah, well, no, there's a bunch of things that go towards screening. So the first person who didn't know that she had BRCA, if you look at the family history, if there's multiple relatives, and if any relative under the age of 40, any relative with bilateral, any male relative, and if a person is diagnosed under the age of 50 in the Wilmot's Pluta Center right now, we'll get genetic testing. So genetic testing is not just one relative. Certainly a cousin or aunt probably wouldn't qualify, but they expand the family tree to look at much more than just one or two. So, there requires a certain number of family members with cancer to trigger it unless the person themselves are under 50.
Okay.
And you mentioned ovarian. Let me just say, When there's ovarian and breast on the same side of the family, that's another sort of red flag.
Megan Mack, I want to give you the floor to finish. I know how much you appreciate, you and Andrea both said how much you appreciate the level of care you have gotten. And Connections listeners, glad to hear that you're doing well. I mean, there's still a lot of hurdles to get through. What do you want to leave with listeners?
Two things. The first, and Andrea's done really well expressing this too. You can live your life with this disease and you do the best you can to get through certain parts that are very difficult. But we have a great community here in Rochester, not only of medical practitioners, but also other women and men who understand this from a first person perspective and are willing to provide support and help and will bend over backwards to be there for you. So, and this is the second piece. If anyone listening is nervous about something, as Dr. O'Connell said, if you feel something, don't be embarrassed. Do yourself a favor, go get it checked. If someone tells you not to worry and you're still worried, trust your gut, go get checked. It'll make a huge amount of difference.
I want to thank all of the guests. Andrea Reynolds, good luck to you. I appreciate you sharing your story. It's going to help people. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Dr. Carla Falkson, thank you for sharing the experience as well. Doctor, we'll talk to you soon. Dr. Avis
thank
O'Connell,
you.
Director of Women's Imaging, thank you for being here as always, Dr. O'Connell.
Thank you for having me.
And you know, Connections listeners love you, Megan Mack.
That's very nice. I love everyone too.
Well,
we have a great team here. Great bunch of listeners as well.
We'll get people updated as soon as we can. Here's to continued good health here. Rob Braden, Megan Mack producing, working. Emory Stein, Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening.